From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Kyle Crawford.
And I'm Jeremy Rappaport-Stein. This week on War News Radio, we bring you the best stories from the fall of 2010. First, we hear about Afghans' love for Bollywood cinema.
Then, we take a look at the problems that Afghanistan's largest bank has experienced.
Next, we examine the state of healthcare in Iraq.
Finally, we talked to Sergeant Dunson about a controversial video he posted to YouTube. This is War News Radio. Bollywood films are immensely popular in Afghanistan. Many Afghans speak Indian languages and identify with Indian culture as portrayed in the movies. Here's Karim Saryahmed with the story.
If you mention Afghan cinema to a movie buff, there's a good chance that they'll want to talk about Siddiq Barmak's Osama. It's a dark film about a girl living with her mother under Taliban rule, and it won a Golden Globe in 2004. The real market for films like Osama, however, is in the West. Actual Afghans have long been far more interested in the action and drama of Bollywood movies for a wide range of sociological reasons. Mohammed Salimi, a media expert who does freelance work making movies, remembers growing up on them.
I grew up in the 80s and 90s, so it was full of, you know, the whole market was full of Bollywood movies, and still it is. The very first Afghan movie made, it was a co-production, a collaboration between Afghanistan and India, and that movie started, you know, that movie industry or movie business, filmmaking art started in Afghanistan in a collaboration with India, and it was a black and white, it was a love story.
The shared culture between Indians and Afghans accounts for much of the popularity of Indian movies. Ahmed Shakib Dost, an anchor for Radio Television of Afghanistan, comments.
They are portraying the image of a family or a society or a community that they have some link with the Afghan culture.
The affinity for Indian culture and Bollywood movies is so great that it actually has had a stifling effect on Afghan cinema. Dost again.
Afghan filmmakers are complaining always that this Indian filmmakers dominated the market in Afghanistan, and no one is watching Afghan movies. And as well as, if you go to the shops, the stores, you can find thousands of Indian films, Indian movies, and the rate is also low, and people can buy it.
According to Salimi, most of these films are pirated versions imported from Pakistan or China, and then sold by local vendors. He says that because of the now 9-year-old war against Taliban insurgents, little attention is paid to this issue.
No, I mean, nobody can stop them. Anybody can go and buy a bunch of them and bring it to the country and sell it.
Though the government seems not to be concerned with copyright issues, the movies are screened for content. Salimi says that movies and music videos on television are also carefully policed.
Any Bollywood song screened there, a movie, if there's any hugging, caressing, or kissing, it's taken out. If a cleavage is seen, it's taken out. The girl has a miniskirt, and you can see her legs. It should be taken out, censored. If not, then the TV gets fined. And it's not just the government. I mean, the government or the Ministry of Culture and Information showing reaction. Parliament shows a strong reaction. Supreme Court is another one sitting there. And Parliament is full of very conservative religious people.
Salimi thinks censorship is distracting, and that limited education and censorship combined limit the influence of high-quality film on Afghanistan. He sees the current state of Afghan film production as coming in two distinct streams.
There are two streams of filmmaking in Afghanistan. One is completely like Bollywood. There's a guy, there's a girl, they're in love, or there's a good guy, a bad guy, there's drug dealing, there's fight, there's song. In the movie, and it's made by some Afghans. They have been in Pakistan. They have spent a little bit of time in Pakistan with a very low knowledge of filmmaking. So it's the same kind of structure, movie making. They don't have necessary and proper equipment to make movie and make it in Bollywood level. So it's really low quality in everything.
Afghan film that is more refined or cerebral, or addresses social issues, often fails to reach the Afghan masses.
There's another one which is a very high quality Afghan cinema that's kind of like has given a identity to Afghan cinema in West, especially in Europe, and that is movies made for festivals and dealing with the political and social issues.
Movies like this, which include the minimalist Osama and Earth and Ashes, are produced by filmmakers educated in Europe or Iran, and are financed by foreigners. Some small-scale movies by one-man production studios have distribution potential if they can get some exposure at European film festivals. There's not much of a market for those movies in Afghanistan, though, so it's no surprise that the government provides no support. Salimi goes further, saying that these socially conscious movies are beyond the understanding of the average Afghan.
Well, let's say in Earth and Ashes, there is a scene. It's a little bit surreal, abstract scene. A grandpa with his grandson is traveling, trying to go and find his son who's working in a coal mine. And the village has been bombed. When he gets there, he gets informed that the village is bombed and everybody's dead. So he loses his entire family. And there's a scene that his daughter-in-law, which is wife of his husband, runs naked while the village is burning out in the background. She's running like a wild horse in with some slow-mo shots. It's culturally not accepted there, and it's also intellectually people can't get what the director is meaning with that, you know, what he wants to say, what's the point here. So it's a little bit beyond the understanding of an average person there.
Part of the young generation includes filmmakers who make documentaries and short movies that are more straightforward, but still socially aware. A typical Bollywood movie, on the other hand, is not only much easier to follow, but provides an escape from reality, rather than a reminder.
They don't want to watch those movies because those movies are pretty similar to their daily lives, what goes in their daily lives, and they don't want to watch it. They want to watch something different from daily lives, and those are the movies made similar to Bollywood movies.
Dust says that language is also a significant factor in the popularity of Indian movies.
Now, most people, most young generation, they only know Urdu. They can know what is going in an Indian movie, but they don't know what's going in Hollywood movie because they don't know English. But within 15 years, within 10 years, the people will get more educated. The people will learn the other languages, mostly English, and they will go for the Hollywood too.
As for the few professional Afghan filmmakers, they may have to do business abroad for some time to come. For War News Radio with Ramya Gopal, I'm Karim Sari Ahmed.
This is War News Radio. Even as security conditions were deteriorating last summer, Afghanistan's central bank had to put a lid on new financial institutions, citing meteoric growth with 17 banks opening since 2003. So you can imagine the surprise when Kabul Bank's customers tried to make withdrawals last month and came back empty-handed. Sam Hirschman takes a look at what happened at Kabul Bank and how Afghan consumers are reacting to the crisis.
With a four-day national holiday approaching last month, government workers crowded Kabul Bank to withdraw their paychecks, but they were beat back by federal police. Muhammad Wali, who works at the Ministry of Justice, saw what happened.
There was a lot of crowd on Kabul Bank and taking money because the people was wonder about that, they will lost their money in Kabul Bank. So the people, everyone is in a hurry to take back their money from the Kabul Bank.
The bank lost $300 million on failed investments. In the resulting run on the bank, customers rushed to withdraw their money. Now, after a government bailout, Afghans are recovering from the shockwaves and wondering if they can trust the system. Wali trusts the government's ability to keep the financial sector working.
When government announced that we are supporting Kabul Bank, so after that count has come less, so the people are thinking that the Afghan government is supporting Kabul Bank, so now they think there is no worry.
But not all Afghans believe in the government. Taraj Rais, a small business owner from Kabul, says more intervention is the last thing Afghans need.
The problem is that...
The problem here is that we here in Afghanistan don't have a stable economy. We don't have an economy. The only thing that we have are the very corrupt politics of an economy and in the hands of corrupt people.
Corrupt political economy in hands of corrupt people.
Rais isn't wrong, according to William Black, a law professor at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. Professor Black says corruption played a large part in the bank collapse.
It appears that Kabul Bank is a classic example of what we call in white-collar criminology accounting control fraud. What that means is the people that control a seemingly legitimate institution use it as a weapon to defraud other people.
Black, a criminologist who specializes in bank fraud, says the losses left the bank
very severely insolvent.
But letting Kabul Bank fail was not an option for the Afghan government. Professor Black explains why.
Kabul Bank became the most aggressive supporter of President Karzai, and it was rewarded with the accounts. So the Afghan government pays governmental employees, including the Afghan army, through accounts at the Kabul Bank. Well, you know, if they default on all the payments to the soldiers, the Afghani government goes away. And if the Afghani government goes away, then the Karzai regime goes away.
Was the collapse inevitable then? Abdul Hilaman, an Afghan who works at the Ministry of Justice, says no.
But this was the government's weakness and slowness to monitor them and to implement the law, even maybe because of the links.
It was the government's weakness and slowness to implement the law because of the links and corruption and privileges, because according to the law, they should have the people who was working in the executive positions, they should be people who are not the big shareholders or the shareholders even. But they all were working, and the government was not saying anything.
People were not the big shareholders or the shareholders even, but they were working, and the government was not saying anything.
The bank was spiraling out of control. The Afghan government showed no signs of prosecuting or regulating, and the Afghan people were going about their business. But where does the United States come in? John Brummett, an auditor who works for the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, says the U.S. government has missed a fair amount.
When you ask about the banking sector, there's a lot of oversight work that needs to be done there. If you ask about some other sectors, I tell you there's a lot of oversight work to be done there. We have identified close to 7,000 different contractors that are supporting the reconstruction program. Just over the last couple years, that needs oversight.
Rummett thinks SIGAR, an agency set up in 2008 to monitor reconstruction funds in Afghanistan, is fighting an uphill battle.
It's a very good thing that Congress set up the SIGAR. I wish they'd set us up a long time ago because we are in catch-up mode. We've been spending money in Afghanistan, big bucks, since 2002, and we've just been on the scene for the last year and a half, and there's a lot of work to be done.
Until a comprehensive U.S. solution is implemented, Brummett says corruption in Afghanistan will continue to slip through the cracks. The Obama administration is currently under pressure from Afghan President Hamid Karzai to stay out of corruption investigations. If the U.S. decides to scale back its role, Professor Black says you can only expect the fraud to get worse. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman.
This is War News Radio. In Iraq, citizens could once expect free, quality, socialized medicine. But like every public service in Iraq, healthcare has been plagued with inefficiency and corruption and been torn apart since the invasion in 2003. Amandine Lee takes a look at the legacy of war on hospitals and healthcare today.
Iraq is fading from world headlines with the declared end of U.S. combat operations, but the toll of war still resonates in the Iraqi healthcare system. For Dr. Hiba Al-Wazan, a gynecologist working in a small hospital in southern Iraq, shortages are a part of everyday life.
We have a small bag of blood.
We have problems. We don't have enough blood. We don't have all the medication and drugs. Sometimes we have big surgeries, but we don't have a surgeon in the hospital. Even the beds. We only have 12 beds for patients. Sometimes normal births have to sleep on the floor, and surgeries sleep on the beds.
Iraq once enjoyed the model healthcare system of the region, drawing in crowds for both education and medical treatment. But decades of war and sanctions in Iraq have put enormous pressure on the system. Looting and conflict damaged 12% of hospitals and flooded them with trauma victims. Now, basic standards of hygiene and sanitation often cannot be met. This has had a devastating impact on the health and safety of the doctors themselves.
For instance, the simplest things, like AIDS tests or hepatitis tests, we don't do these tests. And so we work and hope patients don't have any of these diseases. You operate on a patient and hope she doesn't have an infection.
Further, the number of doctors actually working in Iraq has fallen, as professionals have fled the country. According to the International Council of the Red Cross, there were approximately 34,000 registered doctors in the 1980s. Since then, the number has dropped to 16,000 in 2008. It's hard to blame those who left. During the worst of the occupation, insurgents terrorized hospitals and even targeted the doctors themselves. According to Newsweek, over 120 doctors were killed throughout the war. Today, security is better, but the conditions in which Dr. Al-Wazan lives and works are horrible.
I am sleeping in a beat-up and dirty trailer outside the hospital. I can't even sleep at night. The place is dusty and filthy. One doctor spent the night with me at my trailer. The next day, she was very sick and quit her job. She had just finished a 5-year medical board. The roof of the trailer had holes, and rain was pouring down on us. It's a torture house. I don't want to talk about the bathrooms at the hospital. That's another tragedy. You can find all sorts of insects and cockroaches.
Rural areas have suffered the most in the decline. Stéphane Dumortier, health coordinator for the International Council of the Red Cross in Iraq, explains.
What is very interesting in the situation of Iraq is the bipolarity. It's not a gap between the rich and the poor, it is a gap between the town and the village. And between Baghdad and Najaf, the south of Baghdad, an area also where people are, due to the bombing, due to the insecurity, put in danger to reach healthcare. So when we see the health system, the poor is left behind. Is not really left behind by money because the access is free. The poor is left behind by the possibility to reach the service, the health center.
Dr. Al-Wazan confronts this geographical divide on a regular basis.
I am forced to refer the patients to Baghdad. We don't even have private clinics that do these operations. Only public hospitals do these operations. Some patients can go to Baghdad, others don't. It depends on their ability and their circumstances.
According to Dumortier, however, things on the whole have improved. In particular, services in urban centers are thriving. There is plenty of medication and supplies, and doctors are plentiful and high quality. If anything, there are too many specialists and too few general practitioners.
The hospitals are functioning a lot better than a few years ago. The stocks are full. They don't need us anymore.
He is also optimistic about domestically produced medicine.
Iraqis do not import medicine anymore. They have their own production. They have a very good quality control system. Chinese medicines are not there, so this is an amazing positive trend in the last years.
The Ministry of Health's website boasts of achievements, like the new hospital opened September 15th in Karbala. However, Sabah al-Baghdadi, an Iraqi journalist residing in Canada who focuses on healthcare corruption, is wary of this progress.
In the news, they say that there are new projects and new hospitals to be opened, but it is all ink on paper. Even if they were to open new hospitals, they lack good medical equipments or the building of the hospital. And honestly, the medical staff is not qualified to do the work. Unfortunately, until now, I still get complaints that some doctors refuse to treat people inside the hospital. They ask them to go to their private clinics. And they tell them, if you go to my private clinic, I will treat you.
But al-Baghdadi also claims there are flaws in Kimadia, the state-owned company that monopolizes imports of medicine to Iraq.
And always, unfortunately, in the Ministry of Health, they import medications that have reached their expiration dates or are about to expire, or sometimes they import counterfeit medicines. There are some medicine which are fake, or those that mimic medicine from known companies. They import it as if it came from a legitimate place or well-known company.
He says that accountability is impossible because problems exist in the highest levels of the healthcare ministry.
The thing is that the current Minister of Health and the people he works with choose to appoint ministers so that they can, through them, write corrupt contracts. Before they appoint a new minister, they bribe him with money and high salaries and agree with him to work on their side. If any case goes to court against one of the officials in the ministry, claiming that he is corrupt, and the judge tries to prevent releasing that minister, the judge would not succeed because of the support of the people in the ministry. Some officials are appointed even if they have a record of criminal acts, and some of them fake their education backgrounds. I tried to publish this, but they bribed the editor.
As stockpiles of medication expire on the shelves, and the Minister of Health allegedly operates beyond reproach, it is the people of Iraq who feel the deficiency in Iraq's healthcare system. For War News Radio, with Chloe Wittenberg and Abdullah Mizyed, I am Amandine Lee.
This is War News Radio. Over the summer, War News Radio reported on soldiers using YouTube to share their experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. U.S. Army Sergeant Leo Dunson was one of the soldiers we spoke to, and recently, one of his videos has created quite a controversy. My co-host, Kyle Crawford, got back in touch with Dunson.
The video, which was posted in April, begins with American soldiers from the 172nd Stryker Brigade stopping an Iraqi driver at a routine checkpoint outside of Mosul, in northern Iraq. After quickly planting a grenade in the man's car without his knowledge, Dunson and his partner repeatedly demand an explanation.
Hey, what the? What's that? What's that? What's that? What is that? What is that? What is that?
No, man.
The Iraqi gestures in denial, and after about 30 seconds, Dunson announces that it was all a joke and shakes hands with the relieved man. Dunson says he was surprised by the attention his video produced.
I was pretty shocked. I woke up to all these calls. And a lot of messages, and I had no idea what was going on.
Although War News Radio first reported on the video in July, it wasn't until Gawker.com and CNN reported on the prank last week that Dunson's video drew national attention. Gawker wrote, "It's hard to imagine Iraqis really appreciate having a grenade stuck in their trunk by U.S. soldiers, no matter how well-intended."
What they had to say in the article was pretty shocking as well. I didn't think so many people would take it so offensive.
In the wake of prisoner abuses near the outset of the war in Iraq, the U.S. military has operated under the microscope of global criticism. But Dunson suggests that his detractors are misinterpreting the video of the incident.
It was all in fun, and even the guy, he laughed with me, and that was it. So it wasn't that big of a deal. I remember the day like it was yesterday. So I remember how it was, not like he was like, petrified of his life kind of situation. I was there. I mean, it might look to them as though he was, but he was not petrified of his life.
As a guest on Russia Today, an English-language Russian TV network, American Army Colonel Joel Hamilton vehemently criticized Dunson's actions, stating that the behavior was unacceptable and would not be tolerated in his battalion. But Dunson has strong words in response.
The lieutenant colonel that goes on the TV and attempted to bash me or slam me into the ground. I can't think of his name, but he said, I would never let somebody in my under my unit act that way. And I'm thinking to myself, well, sir, you're not even out in the field, so you don't know what those guys are out there doing.
Dunson explains that people don't understand the pressure weighing on soldiers in Iraq. He says joking around is one way to relax and pass the time.
I'm here for a year and a half. You want me to be serious the entire time? You know what I mean? Do you want me to sit here with my gun pointed at every single person I come to and shoot and kill everybody that I come across? Is that what you guys want us to do? You know, because if that's the case, then that's how a lot of people end up dead for no apparent reason.
Dunson believes that his actions were in line with the stated U.S. mission in Iraq.
I apologize if it offended anyone, because I never did it in any intent to offend anyone. You know, and they got to realize that they talk about trying to win over the Iraqis' hearts and minds. I'm a soldier. I was actually over there on the ground. You know, I'm not one of these people that's just standing back in the field and from the newsroom saying, oh, let's try to win hearts and minds. I was over there winning hearts and minds.
Back at home, Dunson reminds us that soldiers don't always leave the experience behind.
Once you're a soldier, you're always a soldier, but yet the system treats you as if you're not a soldier anymore. And I think that that is jacked up for them to treat their people that way, because you can't train somebody how to kill for 5 years and then, once they're done, expect for them to just forget how to kill.
Following his deployment in Iraq and subsequent discharge, Leo Dunson has a new mission. Now he is an aspiring rapper whose music focuses on veteran struggles. He just released his new album, American Soldier. Dunson isn't upset about the negative media coverage. In fact, he sees this as a way to get his name and music to a greater audience.
This is an absolutely 100% good thing. There is absolutely no such thing as bad publicity. I don't care if they had me on TV, butt naked. You know what I mean? Like, there is no such thing as bad publicity. You can put me over there and try to throw me to the ground and say, oh, Sergeant Dunson, he's such a horrible guy. I hate this dude, blah, 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 blah. But the music speaks for itself.
His album touches on a variety of themes, but most important to Dunson are the songs that talk about the challenges soldiers face when they return from war. Dunson was homeless for a time when he came back from Iraq, and his most recent music video, I Went to War, is about homeless veterans. The attention leaves Dunson optimistic.
I'm 100% positive that it'll be a major spike in record sales, that's for sure.
Meanwhile, Dunson has taken a job at a casino in Las Vegas and continues adjusting to life after combat.
Just trying to live a normal life.
Dunson believes that his music expresses something all veterans can relate to, and that much of his support will come from the community of veterans still coming home from the war zones. For War News Radio, with Aaron Moser and William Lawrence, I'm Kyle Crawford. That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
On our site, you can also comment on this show or on our past programs. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Jonathan Kwan. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Kyle Crawford.
And I'm Jeremy Rappaport-Stein. Until next time, thanks for listening.